Welcome to episode 32 of All of Your Business. These are the vulnerable, authentic, and unfiltered stories of business owners whose currents raise tides that lift all of our businesses, communities, and dreams. On this episode of the podcast, we're speaking with Lakiana Drury of Word is Bond PDX. And now your host, Michael Jonas.
Well, thank you for doing this podcast. First and foremost, I want to ask you about your name. I hope people ask you, but tell us about your name and what it means and why you're given that name.
Yeah, a lot of people honestly don't ask a lot about it. They usually will comment on it like, oh, it's beautiful, or like, where'd you get it from? Or like, da, 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 like just some kind of comment like that. But I think that's a great question because my name is central to my identity. And I'm very fascinated with names because there's, you know, unless you change it, it's one of the pieces of your identity that you don't really have control over. But I always find that people's names a lot of times suit them. And that's the case for me. So there's so many intersectionalities. So my name is Lakiana. And it's a West African folktale about a little boy with a spear. I'll send you the link to a song by this Ugandan singer, Jeffrey Oryema, who does a beautiful rendition of it. But I was given that name by a combination of my mom and my dad. My dad is from South Sudan, which is right below Egypt. And then my mom is from Wisconsin. And her ancestry is Irish and West German. And my father wasn't born in East Africa, but there was a civil war. And so he left and was going to school in various countries in West Africa and eventually ended up in Liberia, where he went to high school and then came to the United States. And so in one of those years of him in West Africa, he was reading an Oxford English reader, and the name was one of the folk tales that he was reading about. So fast forward to when him and my mom had me, he wrote a whole list of all these African names and then had my mom choose from that list. And so that was the name she chose. And it's a folk tale about a little boy with a spear. And as soon as she heard that, she was like, that's the name. And so basically the story goes, it's a little boy, and he starts off with a yam that he finds on his way to school or on his way from school, and he trades it for various objects. At first, it's like a pail, like a bucket, and then there's like an axe. And then eventually he ends up with a spear, which is a symbol of a warrior in African society. And so when he finds the spear, he starts singing the song. He says, "See me, Lakiana, with my spear, which the old man gave me, the old man who broke my axe, the axe which I got from the women by the water, who took my bucket to get water, the bucket which my mother gave me because she ate my yam, the yam which I found by the school." And then he just reiterates the whole story and says, "See me, Lakiana, with my spear." So it's interestingly enough, you know, my dad, I met him when I was 10. And my mom had been telling me for years about the story. And then when I met him, he said he's going to track down the story. We never actually have tracked it down. I've actually narrowed it down to like, it's in an Oxford English reader, but I haven't secured a copy of it. But when I was growing up, my nickname was Lucky. And I didn't choose that name either. It kind of came around when I was like 5 years old and I got to school, and you come into contact with the American education system, and it is ready to tame you and pull all the vestiges of your identity away from you. And so I was given that name because it was easier, you know. Teachers couldn't pronounce it. I had no context for it growing up with my white mother, other than what she told me, right? I'd never been to Africa. I didn't know my father till I was 10. So it's been a whole story of my own identity. But then when I got to like I was about 21 and I went to college, and I really got into like reading Malcolm X and my Black identity and things of that nature, I came to realize just how powerful that name was and how special and how unique it was, right? Because it's just like, you don't meet many Lakianas. I've never met any of them, any other Lakiana. And so I really just came to embrace that name, embrace my Black and biracial identity. And so that's the story of my name.
Yeah, that's a great story. I look forward to hearing the song.
Yeah, it's a dope song.
I'm picturing you with like a spear and yams.
Yeah, that's I feel very much I have a warrior spirit, and I feel I am a kid at heart too. You know, I always have had a playful spirit and energy. So I think those are all very applicable to me.
Yeah. What about your last name? Do you know what that means?
Drury, other than it being in a nursery rhyme about the Muffin Man, I'm not too familiar with it. It's Irish. My father's last name is Yatoma. So if you put my whole name together, it's Lakiana Michael Yatoma Drury. I think that's really beautiful. My mom switched my name over to Drury when I was about 5. So that's been another like thing. Like my dad wanted me to change it back. I like it. I like the Yatoma. I feel like it kind of fits a little bit more with Lakiana, because it's like Lakiana and Drury. It's like, what the hell? But it kind of fits too, right? Because like I believe I am a clash of cultures, right? I'm Irish, I'm Black, and I'm white. Like the pieces that made me are still to this day at war with each other. So I feel like it's a good clash of identities.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And that, you know, that brings me to asking you about what was it growing up like growing up in what, Madison, Wisconsin?
Madison, Wisconsin, yeah.
I mean, what is that like for you in general as a kid, but then also as being biracial and I presume a pretty white area?
Yeah. So in order to answer that question as honestly as possible, I have to try and take off my adult brain, which is in 2021, where race is such a big issue. And, you know, all of the racial terminology that I've learned throughout the years, right? And take me back to little me, who didn't have any context of that. And so I'm writing this poetry memoir about my whole identity. So I've kind of really explored and looked into this. But I would say my childhood was peaceful for the most part. I always felt to a certain degree as an outsider, because it's not even for biracial people. Well, maybe I can only speak from my experience, but it's not very often that people have parents that don't quite look like them, right? Like I grew up with my mom, so she's never looked like me or my siblings. So, you know, there was that factor in it. You know what I'm saying? Like, sometimes I say, are we adopted? And people would ask her, like, where'd you get the kids from? Like things of that nature. But we grew up in the second largest city in Wisconsin, the first one being Milwaukee, which was and is, of what I'm told, still one of the most segregated cities in the United States. Madison was very similar in demographics to Portland, which means absolutely nothing when I'm a kid because I don't know about Portland. All I know is that. And so I grew up in an area that is predominantly white, and most of the kids of color that I know were termed by the school to be low income. So those things in my mind subliminally sunk in really deep. I went to out of district schools because my mom worked in one area and we lived out of district where we could get a nice condominium. So when I would go to school, all the students who lived around the school were the white students. They like, oh, there's Josh's house right there across the street. There's Adam's house right over there. There's Ben's house. And I didn't think much about it. No one sat me down and was like, hey, did you ever think about like why all the white kids live right around the school? But that's just how it was. All the Black kids and brown kids lived in like apartments and stuff like that. And so that was subliminally just registered in my head. Now, the other thing I had to understand about race and my understanding of it was I would often get asked, what are you mixed with? And in my 5, 6, 7, 8, 9-year-old brain, I only knew two races, Black and white. So the question of like, what are you mixed with, was almost like akin to asking me like what planet was I'm from. It's like, there's only one possible answer. Like I'm Black and white. Like I didn't realize you could be biracial, like not biracial, but like black and Mexican, or like Japanese and African-American. So, you know, so I'm trying to give you just a context of what I understood about race during those times. So for me, it wasn't like, I'm like, oh, like this was a completely racist town. It might have been, right? And I'm just going to say it probably was, because it was predominantly white and we live in a society that's still heavily racist, right? It doesn't mean like everybody was sitting outside with a pitchfork and a KKK robe, but it just is what it is. So, but I would just say, just to kind of sum that up in a really long answer, I just like this question a lot. My childhood was okay. What I experienced, the adversity I experienced, I attributed at the time and still attribute now to just the challenges of growing up as a youth, right? Whether it was bullying, whether it was struggling with academics. I know the academic piece was compounded by the fact that I was Black, but I also know it was a little bit alleviated by the fact that my mom was white, because if my mom had been Black and she showed up to the school the way she had to show up to help me get through school, she would have got a different reaction. So I believe that I have secondhand white privilege. I have a whole white family that, again, I interacted with, but all of them, they lived in houses. We were the only ones that lived in a townhouse on the outskirts of town. They all, in their families in these different cities, they were like the white kids in my neighborhood, in my school. They lived right next to the schools. They had two parents. They had a house. They had multiple cars. Everything in my life felt like it was always like just, and it really was like my mom was just okay, right? Like we never came home with the lights cut off. We had birthdays with nice gifts and things of that nature. So we were just making it, but it was never like an abundance the way I saw or perceived that the white kids had. Like they just, like they had everything. It was like, oh my gosh, like you live right across the street, you go to home afterwards. So I would say I didn't encounter a lot of overt racism, but there were multiple moments that I cannot 100% say were not due to race. The one I can absolutely say is how I was treated in the school system, which was 100% race-based. And the fact that I only had one Black teacher growing up, the fact that I was in a mentorship program, the Big Brothers and Big Sisters program, and the wait list to get a Black male mentor in that program was 2 years. Those are systemic inequities that exist throughout the country, but they were there also in Madison, Wisconsin too.
Yeah. Well, and you said that they categorized you as low income, and then once they did that, you know, and then there's low income as low income, and there's low income as in, you know, these are families of different race.
Yes.
So
yes.
Do you think that because of that categorization, you were treated differently? I know oftentimes a school will say, oh, well, that's, we're doing that to give them more opportunity. But then it ends up being that you don't expect as much, or you give them the scraps, you know,
it was a both and, right? Like there was some perks that would come out of it, you know, like at Christmas time, they would send us home with gifts and stuff like that. Like those are the ones that we could see. You know, my mom didn't have to pay for lunch. That's a perk, right? We were on free lunch, but those were terms like, oh, free and reduced lunch and low income. And those are such loaded terms. And we absolutely were labeled with those. And my mom resisted those labels fiercely when we were children. And that in tune, you know, caused it within me too. I didn't always realize it, but when they said low income, you just felt like, oh shit, like, you know, you just felt that heaviness of it. And then when I was in sixth grade, I was diagnosed with a learning disability. So that further stigmatized it. And that one I think was even more of a aggressive term, right? And I would just like, it's such a loaded term. And when teachers see that on a sheet of paper, yeah, they already got in their mind like what you're about or what you're capable of. I think most of them, I think there are great teachers that can overcome that and can think about that and can look at a child and see like what their strengths and abilities are. But the feedback that I got non-verbally and sometimes verbally from my teachers was they didn't see me achieving. And so I internalized that and believed accordingly.
Sure.
To that, graduated high school with a 2.3.
Sure. Yeah. And there's a lot of studies about that, like self-fulfilling prophecy and Pygmalion effect, where like if you tell one group of kids, you know, they're great and they're going to do well, they're great and they're going to do well. If you talk down to another group, that's what they are. That's what they know they are. So.
Yes. Yes. But, and all those foundations, that the white supremacy foundation for me was laid very, very young. Subliminally, right? It was the field trips we went to, it was the books we read. Everything was based in whiteness. So no one told me like white is the best or the greatest, but it was very evident that that was the case based on what I saw around me.
Well, and that's what I was going to ask you, you know, being in history or English, you know, when you read story, you know how they have like, there's like a cute story about Harriet Tubman. And then, you know, there's stories about like the West being heroic and cowboys, you know, like everything's just watered down. It's not the truth.
Right.
They don't talk about 400 years of oppression. They talk about, you know, slaves having dinner with their master and, you know, so there's this like cute whitewash history. So I guess my question for you is when you were in school, did you ever look at that and go, this is not true. This needs further investigation. I'm going to learn history by myself. Like what, or did that happen later on as you got older?
Yeah, it happened later on when I got older. I wish I could package my brain and go back to sixth grade, fifth grade class. You know, so some of the things that stand out to me was I met my dad when I was 10 years old in fourth grade, and I still have this report I did on South Sudan. I was always fascinated with it even before I met him, with just, you know, what my mom would tell me, oh, your dad's from Sudan and it's in Africa, it's right below Egypt. And so I did my report on that, and I can still, because I have the report still, I can still see the red C plus on that page. You know what I'm saying? And it's just like, I put so much into that, you know, that report. And to the teacher, just, it wasn't good enough. It was a C quality work. And I think that that misses the whole point of everything, right? And it's just like, it just doesn't validate a student. You don't understand like why they did that report, or like what did they actually take out of it? And I hate the grading system. But, you know, I didn't read Malcolm X in high school or middle school. I was not even familiar with them. They had basically the two heroes. They just bring them up year after year, Rosa Parks, Martin Luther King. And they would go into slightly more detail every time they, you know, did it. Right. And they just, but by the time, just like, that's all I know about Black history. So it really took a long time. I didn't have any Black teachers. I had a Black mentor through the Big Brothers and Big Sisters program. So that helped a lot of it. And so I had to pick up the understanding of Blackness and Black history, but I did self-teach myself eventually, but I didn't go into it with the meaning, with the idea of like, I want to teach myself what my teachers hadn't taught me. I was just like, I'm curious and just, I like this show. Like I eventually saw Roots and like that, like blew my mind. I was like 19. I was like, whoa, like this is what this is about. Like, okay. Like I kind of had a sense of them finally reading Malcolm X. Like, oh, this is why people like him so much. So it was like a delayed, like aha moment where it's like all those things kind of came together. And some things just led me into it. Like the fact that I like reading, the fact that I like history led me to an exploration of those things. Nowadays, right, we live in an era where it's like, it's all around us and it's so hyped up. So it's like, it's a different, I would be curious to know like what it would be like to learn it now as a youth. But at the time it was almost absent from my education, almost 100%.
Well, you see the critical race theory debate and all that. So I guess it depends on what state you're in. That's what you're learning.
Yeah. 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 And then just parents, you know, my mom did a wonderful job of raising us. If I was to go back and give her a critique, it would be to, you know, she was adamant that I have a Black male big brother and big sisters program, which they matched me in like 2 months. I don't know how it happened, but it just did. But I think there's even more she could have done to educate herself and know, putting my 2021 brain on, right? Just about like raising Black children and how to, you know, make sure, I mean, but she put us in things, you know, like for someone who wasn't well-versed, she didn't do like a terrible job. We were in the African American Ethnic Academy in sixth grade. We, you know, she had us in Big Brothers, Big Sisters programs with Black mentors. She, you know, did her best without like a strong, like kind of white, like fake philosophy on it. Just kind of just like, I just want my kids to kind of like know these things, you know, because sometimes it kind of gets a little overboard with like, when my children said, must. Yeah.
Said that, my mind went to Rachel Dozier.
Yeah, exactly. Like people like that. Just like, it wasn't that intense, you know, but it was, you know, she did without coming across as unauthentic, but always encouraged us to do whatever we want. And I think that's the main piece of my childhood, that I was 100% shaped by her and her outlook on the world. And I would not be in the position I'm in today were it not for her, and to a degree, the privileges her white skin afforded her.
So a lot of people talk about, you know, who are biracial, not really being sure of their identity or having two identities or kind of struggling about it. You know, I think about not just Barack Obama, but, you know, people who sort of talk about like having to discover the other parts of them. So I think with your dad, I mean, were you ever able to ask your dad about what is it like to be Black, you know, where are we from? What is it, you know, tell me about Uganda, tell me about, or did you not have that opportunity?
I did. So, you know, him being from, he's from South Sudan. And so from being from there, he has an African immigrant experience, I would say more so than like a African American experience. So, you know, I got a lot of the, what does it mean to be Black from my big brother, Kevin, who is from Detroit. So between the two of them, I got a lot. My dad, if you have an African parent or someone who's from a country that experiences war, one of the two, you will get the, not a lot of answers from them in those kind of situations. So like, some people ask me, how do you not know like where your family is in South Sudan? I'm like, I don't know, man. That's just a master of not answering a question, but answering a question. I can't explain it, but he just avoids it. And it just, it's not, it's never been really clear like what happened to him there or why he left or all the details or like where any of his family is besides him. So that's something. But I picked up a lot of my understanding about Blackness of just being around him and experiencing his. And that's why I learned just about being African. And that's really helped me. And like, because when I see other African men or African families, now also I've been to Africa a couple of times, so that's like kind of sealed it in as well. But I understand that culture a lot for not having lived a lot in it. And then for African American culture, just with being with Kevin, he, do you know the group Dead Prez?
I've heard of it.
Yeah. So political hip hop group, they came out with an album in 2001 when I was like in seventh grade called Let's Get Free. And it was about like socialism and like Black liberation. Like, and I'm in seventh grade, just now I was in sixth grade. Like, and these concepts were just like blowing my mind. Most of them going over my head, but they were really awesome as well. And I would, they, I kind of came back to them later on after having listened to the album, and I was like, oh, that's what they were talking about. So when they were talking like fuck all the high school teachers, I was like, now I, at the time, I was just like, yeah, like that was a cool lyric, but now I like understand it at a deeper level. So I think I pieced together. I never really had a blueprint about what it means to be Black. There isn't really one, right? It's so for every person, every Black person, there's a different Black experience. But I would say being biracial, you definitely feel that crisis. I experienced it. I feel like most biracial people do, of being divided between two places. But in conversations with other Black people, I've seen that it can even be common amongst people with darker skin or two Black parents. You know, like if even if you're as dark as and Black as you want to be skin color wise, if you're not doing certain activities or acting a certain way, there is this pressure about being Black. And I think it comes from a history of racism that attempts to confine Black people, confine and define Black people. And so like, I just don't think there's a race in this world that's more confined about what it means to be them than Black people. And we're told so much about, this is how you act Black, how you talk Black. These are the movies you watch. This is the clothes you wear. This is the way you carry yourself. This is the way you talk. And it's like, the complete opposite of that is white people, who can be literally anything they want, right? You'll never hear another white person, another white person. Like, you're not acting white enough, right? Like, they could go off and be as black as they wanted to be. You know, they could go off and dye their hair any kind of color. They could change their name to something completely ridiculous, and their culture still embraces them. But that's also because of white privilege allows them to be whatever they is they want to be. Where Black culture, we are constantly defined and put in a box. And so then it's, what's the word I'm looking for? Just like reiterated by Black people themselves. So I felt a lot of that pressure I feel like I felt a uniqueness of it because I've never felt Black enough, because I'm always like in my biracial identities and wanting to feel that. But I think there's also a large group of other Black people that I've talked to. They're like, yo, I've been Black my whole life. And I was in an honors class and they're telling me I wasn't Black because of that. Or like, you know, I like drawing and they told me I wasn't Black enough. And I'm as dark as they come. So I've learned and experienced Blackness and really understood what it means in a more fuller sense. But I know that there is still peace with the biracial identity that's left to be explored and understood and just reckoned with.
That is a really good point that, you know, a lot of white people see Black people or Hispanic people as like a monolithic, you know, like all Black people, but that's not the same for white people. And if I'm looking at white people, I mean, there's people in the Midwest are not like people on the East and West Coast. Everybody's completely different. But one of the things that you made me think of is when you're talking about like what a Black person should be or what society wants them to be, I think one of the reasons why I was listening to this today, the Montero album, Lil Nas, and
like, I listen to it.
He just doesn't care. But I think people talk about it, like even people that hate him, it's surfacing as a conversation piece because, you know, first it was like, oh, he's Black, he has a country song. You're not supposed to fit into that box, you know, and then it's Black and you're gay, and then you're Black and you're, you know, doing this or you're doing that. And so I'm a really big fan of people, obviously if there's a point to it, but, you know, pushing limits, engaging in conversation, being who they are, and then putting that forward. So there's a lot of people who do that. Not just people like Lizzo, Lil Nas, but, you know, people every day, like at a meeting where someone's like, I don't care. I am, you know, a Black woman. I'm a queen. I'm going to tell everybody what I think. Like, I'm a big fan of those people because,
yeah,
you know, not everybody's loud. But I think that's what's needed, because for so long, Black people were not only oppressed systematically, they were oppressed on who they were, who they are as a personality. You have to act a certain way if you're in a meeting, or you have to do this, or you have to do that. But all of that is such bullshit, you know? So
yes,
I really enjoy the when people are, hey, I'm going to be exactly who I am. I just don't care anymore.
Yes. I think to a certain degree that there is an element of acting, because of course they do care. And of course it comes at a large personal expense to them, whether it's mental, physical, in some instances, to be their authentic selves. And I would say to a degree, you know, we're all experiencing some kind of psychological, you know, messaging and stuff like that. But I think for Black people, especially in the United States, right, because we do remember there's experiences of Blackness outside the United States, but especially in the United States, at the epicenter of white supremacy, that, you know, our psyches are at war with this country, right? Because we're trying to fit ourselves into a country. You have to wrap your mind around the fact that this country was not built for you, has a very ugly legacy, and then get up and go move about your day, knowing that a lot of those underlying elements still exist. So it's an emotional mental toll.
The country was built by Black people. That's the sad thing.
It's right.
Not only is it that the country wasn't built for you, it was built by you.
And you, but not for you, exactly.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's, and then as you know, it's a constant, and that was one of the questions I want to talk to you about later. You know, there are a lot of people who are like, oh, racism's over, read a Black president. And they'll say like, oh, microaggressions don't exist. But it's like, have you ever been followed, you know, in a Walgreens? Have you ever been fearful of your life while driving home at night? Like, there's this sort of thing where people in America, they'll tell you that, oh, it's a post-racial world and we have, you know, affirmative action and we had a Black president and everything's good. So, I mean, what's your response to someone who sort of is blinded by that and just says like, oh, everything's great?
I would say, I was just telling a friend of mine last night, everything in this country operates around race. Every single thing. This country was founded on issues of race, right? Whether you look at the indigenous populations that were here first, or the, you know, the enslavement of Black Africans, And then that's never for one part disappeared from this country. It has improved. So to anybody that says it's the same as it's not, it has improved. But in the improvement, the racism has become more systemic and more hard to identify. And it's on an autopilot, right? Where it's like at one point it was perpetrated by individuals that were outwardly racist, where a lot of our system now can operate without individual actors being racist, right? Like I can go work at a school as a Black person and perpetuate a racist system just by entering into that system and teaching the curriculum, because the curriculum and how it's set up and the structure of the school perpetuates racism. And then you have this fallacy of the model minority, which I loathe the term minority, but you know, you have that this model person of color, like a Barack Obama, like Mae Jameson, right? And you take your pick.
Michelle Obama,
right? And they show you, but they are an exception to the rule. They are not the rule. They are not the proof that the rule does not exist. Racism is still here. And so it's like you have to, like, it does, like, did Barack Obama's presidency move the Black agenda forward? I'm not sure I would say the Black agenda, but it broke open race in many, many ways, in the sense, even at the baseline level, that could a Black person even win the presidency? Until he actually won, most people who didn't believe Barack Obama would win that I knew when I was in Madison, Wisconsin, were other Black people. And it was not because they didn't want him to win. It was because they knew the history of this country, and they, until they saw it, they would not believe it was possible. So it's a complicated thing, but it's like they hold those examples up as in like, well, this person can do it. Anybody can do it, right? You got survivors of people who've beat cancer on, you know, stage 4, stage 5, but that doesn't mean that someone at stage 2 or stage 1 are like, oh, well, everybody can beat it, and this person just is strong enough to overcome it, right? It's like, those are the exception, right? And, you know, we love to bash Obama. Oh, you know, it's like the country got so woke after Obama became president that now it's like, oh, he really wasn't that good. And so you got to understand, right? It was a Black man in a system run by white people. You could have the president, vice president, both be Black. White folks control every other system within it. So it's like, you have to understand the system of race. Almost got in an argument with this guy over the internet the other day. He didn't believe systemic racism was real. And it's just like, there's only so much you can do to educate people. I think it really starts with our younger generations, like educating children about what racism is. Because people think racism is just about like individual actors being bad people, and that everybody can just be equally racist, or everybody can be racist. And I personally don't believe that people of color can be racist, because we don't have the agency and the power to even if we personally have prejudice against someone, we can't weaponize our race the way a white person in this country, or really around the world, they could. At this point, white supremacy is so large spread that at any time a white person wants to utilize their whiteness, they have that ability to, in a way that Black people never in a million years could. Even if they're prejudiced against any X amount of people, they can kick you out of their personal business or their home. They could say a mean word to you, but a white person could bring the entire system against you if they wanted to. You look at the woman who was doing bird watching with the dog in New York City with bird watching, and she called the police in an attempt to cash in on her whiteness.
Amy Cooper or something,
because
she saw a Black man in a park, she thought that she was in danger.
Right. And she was going to play her white card and bring the full force of the system. No Black person can call the police and get a response out of them the way a white person could, right? Or when they show up and they see the victim's a white person versus it was a Black person.
I think your name, like Barbecue Becky or whatever her name, the lady who saw Black people barbecuing in the park and called the police.
Right. Trayvon Martin, a white person, a white boy will never be mistaken to be in the wrong neighborhood as long as he lives. You know, Black people are always questioned about why they are in a certain area, why they're dressed a certain way, why they're doing some random regular activity that everybody else does. And so I think there's a lot of examples if we want to see, but people, and I'm learning more and more and coming to understand more and more, is people live in realities, and some people live in realities that they choose not to see, or they've been indoctrinated so hard or so for so long that it's very hard for them to see outside of that. To which point I believe that a lot of white people are victims of a system that doesn't allow them to fully be who they could be, which is an open person that accepts a lot of different people from different racial groups and all backgrounds. And I think that's my idealistic dreamer perspective, that one day we could get to that. And that's
awesome. So, first of all, how do you go from Wisconsin to the Northwest? And then how did you start Word Was Bond?
Yeah. So, 2014, right before I went to teach English in Beijing, China, I had this idea with my friends that I wanted to see the Pacific Northwest. Like, I didn't know it as that term at that time, but I wanted to go like to the left of Wisconsin and see like the Badlands and like Oregon and like Seattle. And so we did this whole trip and kind of went up through there over 2 weeks and came in contact with Portland, which one of my friends at the time wanted to go to school there and my brother really liked. And so fast forward a couple of years later, I was teaching in Philadelphia and kind of exploring different career options outside of that school, and was exploring Portland and found the school that I ended up at, Rosemary Anderson High School. So came out here, interviewed a couple of times, got the job and said, deuces, we're coming out here and see what's going to happen. Came here, I was about 27 years old. I'm 32 now. And it was just like at a moment in my life where I was just looking to kind of really build my career without kind of thinking of it in that term. But I was hungry for something new. And so my first year of teaching went extremely well. I was at quote unquote an alternative high school, serving students that were very similar to who I was when I was a kid. And the CEO of the school, Joe McFerrin, at the end of the school year was like, hey, there's this group of community members who want to do a summer project around connecting youth of color and law enforcement. Okay. And I have a lot of views on that, but I was like, I'm really passionate about young men of color and empowerment. So like, let's see what we got. And they threw out this plan together. I was planning to go to Europe the whole summer. I had the whole train tickets, plane tickets bought. I was just paycheck to paycheck, like financing the trip. And I was like one paycheck away from getting all the hotels and like, I'm set to go. And so I go to this meeting at this, what was called the Broadmoor Golf Course on, I think it's Columbia. It's not there anymore. And I go into this room. It looks like this table with all these executives sitting at it. All these fancy white folks, a couple of Black folks sprinkled in there. And I'm just like brand new teacher. And it's the end of my first year teaching. And I'm just like, whoa, like, what did I just walk into? Kind of like unsure. I still didn't have that full confidence in myself. Like, you know, like I'm really like, it's like the way I am now to a certain degree. And they basically were like, we're trying to start a summer project and we're looking for someone to like put the curriculum together and teach it. And they had all these resources, like ropes courses. There was like police officers and they're like, we've got access to training facilities and like cell phones, one of which I still have right here. It's another story. And, you know, I'm a teacher, so I'm used to like fighting for a box of pencils, you know, and scraping up for all the little supplies. And so to sit in this room with all of these resources, it's like a dream come true. I'm like, man, all you want me to do is like bring a curriculum together and get some young men in this program. I'm like, scratch the trip to Europe. I want to do this for the summer. So went around and got some youth for the program, put together a curriculum, said we're going to work with young Black men because that's my passion. And I was like, we're working with the police and doing those engagement, what better group to do it? And that was the start of Word Is Bond. So the summer program went really well. I went back to my CEO and in so many words was like, I want to make this a nonprofit without really knowing what that even meant. And that was the start to my next career move. And so he mentored me and showed me how to do it. And so we officially named the program Word Is Bond after a Nas song, the original Nas. Dang, what's the song? oh, I can't even remember it right now. I think it's One Love. And in the beginning of the song, he's like, yo, where does Bond? And I was just writing with a notebook full of names that I was thinking of for the organization. And I wanted something that wasn't going to put us in a box and didn't sound like something from the 1960s, like the Brotherhood of Black Leaders, or like, you know, the Young Men's Leadership Brigade. And I didn't even want anything with men in it, because I was like, I wanted to be versatile. I wanted to be able to take this. I was thinking of groups like Apple and like Microsoft, where it's like the name had really nothing to do. Well, it could have it, but like it could be its own thing, right? And so it did have something to do with it in the sense that it was a hip hop term, and word is bond, right? Like it's a leadership trust, statement, right? Like
bond of trust.
Exactly, bonds of trust, bonds between youth and police through our words. And to the youth themselves, like, my word is my bond, and like instilling that in them. And I also wanted something that was kind of hip too, right? Like that would be kind of new age. And so that's kind of how it came up. And it was like everything else in my life. When I learn, I'm a hands-on, observe for a little bit and then start doing it myself kind of a person. So I just dived into the world of nonprofits, and I just hit my head and scraped my knees along till we kind of got to where we were. We had a lot of support along the way. I experienced everything that you could experience in Portland in doing so, from overt to covert racism, to finding funding, to working for a year without a salary, to now we have an office and just hired one of my former students as the administrative manager, and are hiring a program manager to work with our 40 something number of youth, and just finished our fifth year of summer programming. So it's been a journey.
I think you're doing a great job.
Thank you.
You have the Rising Leaders program. Can you talk about
that? Yes, sir. What is it about?
Yeah, talk about the Rising Leaders program and what
that is. Yeah, so that's the flagship program. So that's the six-week paid internship. We take a group of young Black men. They sign up for the program. We advertise to schools. Some of the students are peer-based. So it's like, hey, I did this program last summer. You should do it. We advertise on social media. They come from us from all over the city. So you got young men that are in private schools that are in 11th grade, and they're like, I got my top three schools that I want to go to next year when I graduate. We got young men that are just coming out of halfway programs, and like, I just was incarcerated for 8 months or 2 years, and I'm just coming back, and I have no idea what I'm doing in my life. We got students who are in public schools that are like, I'm somewhere in between. I'm not really sure if I want to go to college. I ain't really had terrible experiences with law enforcement, but I'm not necessarily like best friends with them either, right? And so all these guys come into this program, each adding their own experience of Blackness, right? Because when we talk about, oh, it's a program for young Black men, we say, well, that's so exclusive. It's just so small. But then you look at the diversity of experiences and you're like, wow, not two of these young men are the same. And so it's a six-week leadership program. They learn public speaking. They meet downtown, so they're seeing different areas of the city, right? So it's not just like neighborhood-based. Like, we're going to go and have a community center in the Black neighborhood, and we're just going to gather all you guys up. No, we're going to bring you downtown where the economic and political power is located. And so we'll go down to these buildings. You'll be able to point out, this is the county courthouse. This is what they do in the system. This is where the city hall is. This is what their apparatus is. Here's the business alliance and their process. So a lot of what we do is trying to expand their worldview, because as I was saying earlier, what is exposed to Black men is so limited. They're shown like three options, and they say pick one of these three, and it's a lottery if you'll even get one, right? You got to get to the NBA, you got to be a rapper, or you can go to jail, right? And the jail is the easiest one for you to get to. The other two is like, you're going to be one in a million if you get there. So we're expanding their worldviews. We get them suits so that they have a nice suit to wear, and teach them about professional excellence. Not to say that you have to wear a suit to be respected. We are very careful about that and making sure that they know that you can put your do-rag on. You can sag your pants. Your pants could drag across the whole floor, and that's probably not the best thing to do, but you should still be respected either way, right? But we teach them how to carry themselves in different ways, how to do public speaking so they can speak in front of a group. We teach them workshop facilitation, and they do Know Your Rights trainings to their peers. And then they learn, most importantly, to tell their story. What is my story? What have I gone through? How can I say that in a way that is powerful and impactful. So they write poetry, they take portraits in their suits, which we put up around the city to show positive images of young Black men. And then every Tuesday is when the officers come in. So similar to how we reach out to the youth, I reach out to all law enforcement agencies, say, hey, we're doing this program, send us some of your officers. They come out of uniform. They come every Tuesday, so 5 days out of the summer, and they host or they engage in a four-ish hour workshop with the youth. First week, we're not talking about race. It's strictly who are you as an individual. And over the weeks, we get deeper and deeper into the conversation to what week four, we're talking about Trayvon Martin. We're talking about Mike Brown. We're talking about systemic racism. The last week, the officers come in uniform. And then we tell the guys, you can come out of your clothes, out of your work clothes, just in your regular clothes, right? So we're both seeing each other, how we would actually see each other if we were to engage on the street. And so they get paid for all this too. So it's a paid internship where they learn leadership skills and all that, dialogue with officers. We have a community celebration at the end where the officers and the youth talk about what they learned. The youth obviously are, you know, the officers are in there 4 days of the summer, 5 days plus a ropes course. But the youth, they've been camping, they're doing all these things. So they're talking about the reading some of the poetry. And in the second year, when they return, if they decide to return, they get to do offsite internships. So taking those leadership skills they learned from the first year and going to, for this example, this summer, one was at the district attorney's office. One was at Titan Freight. One was at Urban League. One was at Hood to Coast Relay Company. So they're learning all different businesses and experiences. Now, never done the third-year program, but the third-year program would be about a six-week trip to West Africa, where they would get to do a service trip over there and get to see and feel their culture in a real-life basis. So working on the funding for that, growing the program, staying patient. You know, if it was me, we would have done that program 3 years ago. But, you know, as I've learned, you know, just the process of how things are actually built and put together. So that's what Rising Leaders in. We've done that. That was our starting program. We've done that 5 years.
That's excellent.
Last summer was our fifth year time doing it. Yeah.
It's all of it is excellent for numerous reasons. I like what you said about how the police officers, they come without their uniform. Mm-hmm. Until the very end, because that's really interesting to develop the trust, you know, like seeing people as people. And yeah. I don't know if you ever as a child had that talk about, you know, there's like a, and I know your mom is white. We talked about your biracial identity, but there's a lot of mothers who have to have that talk with their child about, you know, when you're out on the street or when you're in a store or when you're at school, this is what society looks like. You have to be careful. Here's why. Or even now, you know, running outside in your neighborhood, you know, like Ahmaud Arbery or anything like that. Like there's a talk you have to have. So I guess, one, did you have that talk? Two, the guys that are in this program, I mean, I would imagine that they've either had a bad history with law enforcement or they're immediately not sure whether or not they can establish trust, and rightfully so. So, I mean, how does that play out? Like,
yeah, I think the talk has become really romanticized in today's society a lot. So with the movie, The Hate U Give, and I didn't have that talk growing up, probably because my mom was white. That was probably one factor of it. And yeah, but it's interesting because it's like, I wish I had, right? Like that would just be another stripe that I could put on me of like Blackness, right? Like everybody has a talk. So I think, I don't think everybody does have that talk. And so I think it's important as we think about that conversation and like how it can be such an example of some of the, what we have to go through as Black people. It's not all, but I have two experiences that were kind of similar to it. One that was the most similar to it was when I was going to college. When I finally got to college and I was like 21 and we went up for there for the first day. And there was like, you know, like big trucks in my experience and many Black people's experience come off as racist, right? When you get these big rigged up trucks. And I remember when we were in the small town, it's like 7,000 students. There was only 100 Black students. I didn't know this. This was my first day on the campus. And I remember this truck like rev by us. And I just made some like kind of like joke or comment about like whatever this dude was about. And my mom was sitting right next to me and she said, she just said something to the effect of, you can't make those jokes anymore because you're up here and this is like a different environment. And I feel like that was her closest warning in so many words of just like, it's just a different environment. And it's, you are different here, especially in this space, or more so than you would be in other spaces. And the other example that I can think of was when I was in sixth grade, I was at her office one day and she gave me some like books to take down to this book resale business and like turn them in and like get some cash and like buy some books with it. And so I went down there and I went up to the register, came right in the store, went to the register, and the guy accused me of stealing the books off the shelf without any context to it. And I had just walked in the store, but then he allowed me to leave with the books. So I went back to my mom's office and told her what happened. And she marched me right back down there and then like laid into the guy and like let him know like, hey, like I just told my son to come down here with these books. He didn't steal them, blah, 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 blah. And so I think those are two examples of, can't 100% say they were race-based or the talk-based, but they were things that I think that I encountered because of my skin color. What was the second part of that question? Like what my students experienced with it?
Yeah, just especially with the events that have been happening, I mean, for a long time, but, you know, we hear, especially in Portland, we hear, you know, we've heard kill the cops, all cops are bastards, you know, fuck the police. It's just on and on. So you're a gray area thinker and you're realizing and your program's realizing that just like not every Black person is bad, not every cop is bad. Like we're going to come together as a community. We're going to meet each other. We're going to figure out. So I guess my curiosity is, in the moment when the cops are meeting your students, is there anger, or is it just like an instant, you know, how are you? Who are you? Let me talk to you as a person. Are there any like words thrown, or I don't know if I can trust you?
There's a lot that goes into it. So I would love to see what would happen if we weren't paying our young men. That's one of the biggest thing that gets them in the doors. I'm getting paid for this experience, right? No Black youth is doing Black backflips off the couch to go sit in a room and have a conversation with police. So we do a lot of discussions pre-police coming in, because they spend at least a week together before they have any engagement with the officers. And we really talk through, you know, what the expectations are. I tell them straight up, a friend, this program is not to get you to like the police. That's not what this is about. So if you come to the end of this program and you're like, I still feel the same way, that is 100% valid. Yeah. And also your predetermination of how you feel about the police coming into this program is also 100% valid. You know, it's not like Black people are just making up ideas of how they like the police just based out of random, like, oh, like I just like they're dogs or something like that. Like, oh, I've never been bit by one, I just don't like them. It's like, no, they're based on actual experiences they've had or from historical, cultural, neighborhood contexts and forms. So a lot of people misconstrue what Word is Bond does is saying, like, if we just sit down at a table, it will alleviate everything. And if we just talk, right? And you got a lot of some people who might have the idea and they see Word is Bond, like, oh my gosh, this is the program. This is what we need. And so it's that we have to resist that. Like, we are going to host these dialogues, but don't have any grand expectations that this is it, or that if I bring these people in this room, that it's going to solve everything.
I like that. So that's what they call it, like toxic positivity. Like,
yeah,
sort of idea of like, oh, we're all, you know, kumbaya, everything's.
Yeah.
I think that's great. There's actually reality. I like what you said. Like, if they walk away having a little bit more respect for each other, great. If they don't, at least they understand where they're coming
right.
from.
Right.
Your goal is not to make this sort of, everybody's going to be best friends.
Right. We're not coming at that expectation. We're not even coming at the expectation that everybody's equal. And I faced a lot of pushback from the original, some of these original people that were involved in this program that wanted to bring people, police and youth together. A lot of them didn't understand what that actually means. And when I would say things like, everybody's not equal in here, or like, we don't all have equal participation in here, they're like, well, what do you mean? This is everybody's program. And it's like, no, this is a program for the young Black men. The officers are there primarily to learn. They're participants in this program, but this program is not for them. And we're not going to sit in a room and everybody gets 50-50% chance to just share their stories and talk. The officers are going to do a lot less talking, and the youth are going to do a lot more talking, because they don't get those same opportunities to speak. They don't get that same recognition. When an officer dies, flags are lowered half staff. There's parades. There's speeches. When a Black youth dies, you'd be lucky if it makes the headlines. And the only time it does is if he was like caught stealing something. And then we can say, yeah, Black kid was shot and killed while doing a theft, right? But we don't hear it just because they are. And so we do it. So helping people understand that and understand how we're going to do these dialogues, and helping guide officers who come back and say, hey, like after week three, like I kind of felt like we didn't get to speak as much and I wanted to share my story. It's like, hey, it's actually by design. Let's talk through that and like why we're doing it this way. And so for the youth then, I had a guy last summer, young man last summer, and he was the first one to apply for the program in April. Then George Floyd was in. And he messages me over social media, like, hey, I don't want to do the program. I don't like the police. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I want that guy in our program. Like, that's the guy I want in our program.
Yeah.
And I'm like, ooh, like now I really want to. So I hit him up and I hit him with a completely different thing than he's expecting. I'm like, hey, let me tell you about the program and why we're doing this. And I explained kind of what I was saying. This is not about liking the police. Like, and I talk about like what you can gain from this and telling your story and all the other elements that you can gain. And I said, laid it out to him. And I said, think about it. And if you are interested in the program, come back and talk to me. Week goes by, he hits me back up and he says, hey, actually, I do want to do a program. Goes through, does an amazing job. That fall, he goes on OPB and talks about the poetry he wrote in the program and the storytelling project. This past summer, he does an internship at Titan Freight Company. He wants to own a trucking company himself. There's a photo of him working on one of the trucks, and his sister took it and put it on social media with a photo of his father in a very similar position working on a truck back in Ethiopia. And it was just an amazing photo, and it's just an amazing connection. And he's taken in what he's learned in this program and done amazing things with it. And that is the core of this program, is helping young Black men see more possibilities, learn more things, put them in the driver's seat, make them feel important and that their story, their existence matters. And so that's kind of where we're at with it.
Yeah, I think that's great. I was going to ask you, people talk about community policing, and it's such a broad, vague, ambiguous term. I mean, what does community policing mean to you? Like, what would be successful community policing?
Policing with an agenda set, designed, and held accountable by community members. I think policing does an important role, but I think it's gotten too ahead of itself, where it sees its role as essential outside of the community. It's only essential within the direction of the community. Anytime you start to say, well, my job, and you know, I have to do this, and you don't know, you're off in the wrong direction. You serve the community. The community doesn't serve you. The community is not supposed to stand down to you. You are supposed to defer to the community. So, and a lot of times officers, you know, they freeze up when you say the word accountability. You should want accountability. That is essential. Name a job that does not have accountability in, right? Oversight, oh my goodness sakes, or reduction of the budget, like, oh, defund the police. Now, you know, some people do take that and mean like they want to take all the police out of there, and that's another story. But, you know, it's gotten to a point where at one point it served the community, but then it got into itself and it is its own entity outside of the community. So community policing means the police live in that community. They are a part of that community. They serve at the request, and they are genuinely interested in serving the needs of the people. And that changes from community to community. It's not just a one size fits all. This is what police do, and we're going to do all of it our way. You have to design and facilitate your everything. All the policies have to have community input, and it hasn't traditionally been there. You talked about all cops are bastards. it would be so easy if we could just say every cop in the world is evil. You know what I'm saying? It would make everything so much simpler. We could just say this group of people is terrible people. But that's it's fortunate that it's not the case. We live in a world where there can be good people in a terrible system.
Sure.
I have met good cops. But there does become a point where being a good person is not enough, right? If you are a doctor, but you keep having malpractices, the fact that the doctor is a good individual at some level becomes unimportant anymore, right? And so to the cops out there that say, I'm a good person, I trust and believe that for a lot of them. But at some level, you have to hold your institution accountable. And being a good officer is not enough. And because you wouldn't do that particular thing, right? Because you didn't do what Derek Chauvin did in Minneapolis, does not help me have any more faith in the system or make the system any better. You have to.
Well, for every Derek Chauvin, there's the people standing around Derek Chauvin.
Right. Right. And who's to say it wouldn't be you? And unfortunately, I think most people in human society are susceptible. Everybody is. They're not any biologically different than we are. That bystander effect, that go with a system that is perpetuating negative outcomes, is something that all humans are capable of doing. And I think that that's one of the things that I would like to see in this, is a little bit more grace for police officers, and that it's not, you know, and that's a hard thing to say, right? As a Black man in a system that's so, that we're seeing such things to say, we have to have compassion. We cannot meet the system with the same tools that the system is pumping out. The system has no empathy. The system has no compassion, no grace. And as Audre Lorde said, you can't dismantle the master's house with the master's tools. And not to get too idealistic, but we have to see the humanity in everybody. We cannot believe in the dogma of our own position that we somehow believe ourselves superior or are unable to fall for the same things that this individual group fell for. Because it doesn't matter what it is, you're this one group of people that you don't like. Everybody has one of those. And everybody has a reason why this is validated. This is why I don't have to like police officers. This is why I don't have to like Republicans or Democrats or Black people or Afghanistan people or Muslims. It's like we all choose our groups of people that we hate. And I think that's the biggest point that we're missing. Nobody's 100% right. The police have some truth in what they're saying about their position, how they're feeling. Black people certainly have their truth. And I think if we remember that no one's truth is absolute, because once you start to believe in your position so much that you're only listening to people like yourself, you've lost.
Yeah. Yeah. That's all great. You are such a powerful speaker. I love it.
I get passionate about these things. Once you get me on a topic, I'm like, man, you gotta interrupt.
But yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, they call those like echo chambers, where you just surround yourself with people who believe the same thing. And
yes.
I think the thing that is hard right now is people are making facts up. They're not believing in truth or science. People are making up history. People are normalizing hate and neo-Nazism. Some will say like, oh, you're progressive. Why can't I have a viewpoint? Well, being a neo-Nazi is not, you know, a viewpoint. So I think that's the difficult thing. But you're absolutely right. There are enough types of people to see the spectrum of people, so that not only are Black people not monolithic, but cops are not monolithic. You know, they're right. Like you said, there are some great cops, and there's even African American cops who, you know, that's kind of an interesting time for them. I
think it is. And it shows that the systems, you know, they're intersectional, right? And just the same way that I'm saying, you know, there's truth in every side, just to your point that you kind of just brought up, it's like, you can't 100% believe in that view to the point where it's like, well, now we just like hold up Nazi views on the same level as, you know, other views, right? There's limits to all of the things we believe in. But yeah, you have to listen to understand. I think a lot of people, I read this quote the other day, are you listening to be heard or are you listening to be understood? And I think a lot of people with the advent of social media, are just talking to be heard and not truly to be understood.
Yeah, that's a powerful one and definitely true. There's also people on social media that think that they're a doctor.
Yes. Yes. Like all sorts of assumed things that they, yeah. And the whole thing about like truth and bending, that's really hard. It's a path that's not, you know, this fake news and stuff. Like there's, I think that everybody to a certain degree lives in their own reality. But what I think is there is an understanding of a shared reality we all live in, right? That, you know, we're on this earth. When you start thinking about it, you're like, well, are we? Like, you know, it's like, I've been reading a lot about like simulation theory. And so it's like hard to know what we actually know, but there's some shared truths that we all believe in that I think it's like a Venn diagram, right? Like you have the main circle where everybody's in, and then you have these other little circles where everybody lives in their own reality. But at some level, we all intersect and there's some shared things that are just the subjective.
If people don't take that step to meet someone new or hear a new idea, they'll never know. So it's sort of the contact and the mystification and the walls come down when you actually meet someone that you're afraid of and you actually figure out what they're about. And you realize like, oh, yes, that person's not so bad, or they're not a criminal, or they're not this, or they're not that.
Right.
You know, or like that cop, you know, every cop in your life is horrible. You meet a cop who you actually say, wow, look how great this cop is and what he's doing that is different from everybody else. So I think that's the time we're in too, is within this culture. I don't know if you want to call it cancel culture or what, but it's very conclusive on one side or the other. So it's, you know, like the all cops are bastards. Well, maybe they're not.
Like, right. No. I don't want to be right. I want to understand. I can't truly, in my opinion, speak on a subject if I have not done my research or talked or at least tried to understand either side. So when I meet an officer, for example, that I get along with, it helps me have a better sense of the system. And it says, okay, If I have something in common with this individual, what does that tell me about the system, right? It's just like scientists learning about life on Earth to make hypotheses about what life could be in other places, right? The more I understand about the system, the better I can understand how we fix it. And so that's where I see what I'm doing and people who take those steps is like, I feel like I'm better able to talk about this because like I'm actually bringing in an open mind to it, right? And it's not to say that Black people have to be friends with cops in order to speak on the system, or that they have to do, like, our trauma is enough to speak on, right? But I do think if you are going to be a leader, right, or trying to create solutions, I think you have to model whatever it is. And me personally, I believe it is important to understand other sides, other viewpoints. I'm not concerned with like tearing other people down. I want to build stuff. I believe that this world can house everybody. We can all get along. As idealistic as that sounds, as out there as it sounds, I've just always been an outwardly optimistic person.
Yeah.
That's yeah.
Okay. So we have 5 questions at the end of the podcast that I ask. So the first question is, what's a quote or a mantra that you live by?
Star Wars, do or do not, there is no try.
Nice. The next one is, what is your favorite childhood memory?
The total experience of growing up in our townhouse on 4157 Bruns Avenue.
What is a failure or mistake you made that actually turned out for the best?
Getting fired from my teaching position in Philadelphia.
What issue or issues keep you up at night?
Racial justice. Humanity. Humanity, too.
And then a fun one. Who is your favorite pop star or favorite band or both?
Dang. I'm gonna go with I'm gonna go with my band. I'm gonna go with Journey. And a pop star, I'm just gonna give you my top five favorite rappers contemporary right now, and then just in general, I'm gonna just go with Tupac, Biggie, Nas, Drake, and just to be as contemporary as possible, I'll go with Lil Baby.
Cool. And then the last part is just how can people find you if they want to know more about Word is Bond? And then are there any shout outs you want to give for anybody in the community?
Oh, man. So website for Word is Bond is mywordisbond.org. We rely on donations. So if you enjoyed what you heard, or you feel like what I talked about with Rising Leaders is a program that you want to support, please donate to our organization. My personal website, I just was tinkering with and kind of got it up and going, is LakianaDrury.com. I'm sure my name is going to be somewhere on this, so you can find that. Shout outs to people. My mom, Mama Benz, Teresa Drury, I want to give her a shout out. My dad, Habib Yatoma, all the young men in Word is Bond, and just our youth in general, you know, all of our youth across this country and across this world, whether you are in Afghanistan and you're not certain if you're going to have school anymore, whether you like my nieces and nephews in Liberia who are in extreme poverty, but they're still going to school, whether you're a youth here in Portland, and you got it all figured out, or whether you're not even sure school's for you, I just want to give a shout out to all of them that we see you, and that, anything that you want to do is possible.
Thank you so much. This was a great interview, and thank you for all the great work that you do in the community.
Appreciate it, Michael. That's my middle name, by the way. I enjoyed the questions. Thank you for letting me rant and rave.
Yeah, no,
for an hour or so.
Take care of yourself. Have a good night.
Yes, sir. We'll talk soon. Take care.
We'd like to thank Lakiana Drury for being on this episode of the podcast. To find out more about Word is Bond PDX, visit their Facebook page at facebook.com/WordIsBondPDX. And of course, a very big thank you to you for checking out this episode of the podcast. Be sure not to miss any of our upcoming guests by subscribing to the podcast on your favorite streaming service. You can also visit alloftyourbusinesspodcast.com for previous episodes, custom gear, and if you happen to know anybody that you think would be a great fit for the podcast, click our contact page and let us know.